nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Today we have Professor Berulis, and the title of the talk will be RF MEMS, Passive Components and Architectures.
Okay, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Dimitri Perolis, and I'm an assistant professor in the School of Electrical and Computer Engineering, and I'm also a member of the Burke Nanotechnology Center. Today I will try to give a tutorial, if you will, on RF MEMS, for particularly focused on passive components and architectures. And it will try to give you a flavor of what has been going on in that area of research for the past approximately 15 to 17 years right now. So I'm sure a lot of you have heard the word MEMS before, and MEMS stands for microelectromechanical systems, and basically it's a word that has started becoming very generic. So it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people, but there are two attributes that are fairly unique about this. So we're talking about micromechanical devices that are batch fabricated with conventional IC fabrication techniques. At least that captures the essence of MEMS. And of course, they have some useful functions to perform. And MEMS have found a lot of different applications in a great variety of domains. So we have MEMS for microfluidics, pneumatics, opticals, and so on. My focus today will be just on the RF MEMS. That's really what we'll be trying to see today. Now, in order to understand why MEMS can help you design a better RF system, it's important to see the requirements that we have today for RF. And they're different than a lot of other fields. So the first requirement is that we're working with impedances in the order of 50 ohms. The reference impedance for a system is 50 ohms, which basically means that if you need to create a short circuit, if you need to create, for example, a switch, as we'll be talking about today, your short circuit, you know, better be something like less than an ohm. We're not really talking about kilo ohms or mega ohms that might be an acceptable short circuit in a digital system. The second thing that we have to keep in mind is that signal loss is really expensive. And that you can see in both in a transmitter and a receiver. In a transmitter, for example, we have power amplifiers, which primarily consume the vast majority of your battery. So if you spend so much power trying to generate, so much DC power trying to generate RF power, the last thing in the world you need is a lossy component that will basically consume that before it even exits your transmitter. Same thing happens from your receiver. The received signals today in commercial and military systems are in the order of nanowatts to picowatts, which basically means that you need an extremely sensitive receiver with the minimum possible loss. So trying to minimize losses is a very central theme in the RF circuits. The next thing is that parasitics are very important. We usually don't care so much about them in a digital system, and we don't care so much as long as you're working in a fairly low frequency. But as soon as you start crossing the gigahertz range, as soon as you start becoming, you know, 10, 20, 40, 90 gigahertz a day, then your life becomes very difficult just because of parasitics. So if you can get a component, if you can get a device that has very, very low parasitics, then your life is a lot better. Linearity. And this is an underappreciated topic. Having extremely linear devices is the key in success in most of commercial systems. And, of course, military. And the reason is because your RF environment is so, so challenging. The RF environment is overcrowded, and as soon as you start having non-linearities, you start mixing your useful signals with unwanted signals. And then the reception becomes very, very critical. And finally, for the past 20 or 25 years, people have started dreaming about multifunctional RF systems. Having, for example, an RF system that is not really transmitting at, let's say, 900 megahertz or 1.8 gigahertz like a cell phone is doing today, but can actually switch bands if necessary, or can perform a different function rather than just being a single transceiver. And starting from this last topic, let me say a few words about the tunable systems and how MEMS can help that. So this diagram on this slide really shows you how a conventional transceiver is manufactured today. It's a black diagram. And if you would like to make this system tunable, you basically have a couple of different ways to do that. The way we do it today, when we manufacture a transceiver that needs to operate, for example, in more than one bands, like, say, a cell phone that works in more than one continent in this world, what we really do is that we fabricate several different receivers, and we use switches to basically select the receiver that we want. Things would be a lot better, and you could reduce the volume a lot more if you had the capability of having tunable components. If, for example, your antenna could be tunable, if there should be a filter that is tunable, then in that case, you could have basically a transmitter and a receiver that had the capability of operating in many different bands without having to have several different circuits. Of course, whether that is possible or not depends a lot on the cost, on the power handling of your tunable components, and on how big those devices are. So the reason that this has not been implemented before is because we didn't have the necessary devices to do that. But MEMS has actually changed that quite significantly, as we'll see. So why MEMS for microwaves? Why can't we use them? There are actually two unique advantages here. There are two attributes that makes MEMS extremely desirable. The first is that there are several really unique features that you cannot find anywhere else. For example, there are devices, as we'll see today, whose power requirements, the DC power that they need to consume to operate, is in the order of microwatts, as opposed to several milliwatts that would be a conventional solid-state device that would perform the equivalent function. So you can actually reduce the power requirements by 2 to 3 orders of magnitude. This is actually the first thing that caught people's attention about 15 years ago when this whole thing started. Also, insertion losses, parasitics, as I was saying before, are significantly reduced here. Third, very high linearity. They're actually the most linear devices that you could ever dream of. And that's why they're becoming so critical in wireless communications. Finally, we're talking about mechanical designs, obviously, but we're talking about really small mechanical designs. The existing circuits, existing mechanical circuits, are in the order of a few tens of microns. And as the technology progresses, those will actually cross the barrier of the nanometer, and they will start becoming hundreds of nanometers. Finally, the second advantage is the fact that the fabrication techniques required for those devices are actually the same existing IC technologies. But I should mention one thing here. MEMS, at least today, they work really, they have very good performance without requiring any of the complexities, meaning you don't need an e-beam lithography to make them. You just need the 3 to 4 micron lithography to make these devices. You don't need any expensive MOCVD tools. The fabrication techniques are actually quite simple, and we'll see an example of them. So I'm going to start actually discussing the particular components, starting by the switch. It's a circuit that we're all familiar with, both from the analog world as well as the digital world. And an ideal switch is a circuit that basically can create an ideal open in the off state and an ideal short in the on state. And of course, you would ask the question, why can't you just do this thing with transistors? I mean, we have transistors. They are pretty good switches. Why MEMS? Why bother implementing a switch using a different technology? Now, the transistors are indeed quite small and are indeed quite fast. One thing most people, when they talk about transistors, they think in the nanometer range, and that's right if you're in a digital circuit. But in RF communications, transistors can be fairly large, particularly if we're talking about high-power components. So we're not in the nanometer range in RF. We're talking about transistors a little bit larger than that. So yes, transistors can be used, but they have a fairly good number of disadvantages. The first is that they're non-linear. Like, you're trying to create an open circuit and a closed circuit by using a semiconducting junction. That is, by definition, something that is non-linear. As you change your power, you're going to create harmonics. And again, for digital, that might not be too bad. For analog, it is deadly. The second is that when you turn a switch on, you need to keep running current through it to keep it on. See, this is very different from a conventional switch that we flip to turn the lights on and off. As soon as we turn the switch on, it stays on. It doesn't need any power consumption. transistors do, which basically means that you increase the power consumptions of your overall system. They actually have quite high loss for high frequencies. Transistors, as we'll see in a couple of slides later, they present several dBs of loss if the frequency starts getting quite high, which basically means that in the on state, you don't have an ideal short circuit, but you actually have a reasonable resistance. Now, again, that resistance might be insignificant if you're talking about a system that has a reference impedance of several hundreds ohms or kilo ohms, but for a 50 ohm, it's not insignificant. And finally, they leak, meaning that the off state is really not an off state. There is a little bit of current that keeps leaking, and that is getting worse and worse as the frequency gets higher and higher. So that is something actually you can understand from the digital domain as well. I mean, Pentium processors from Intel, in their off state, they leak a lot today because the transistors are not ideal in their off state. So if there was a way to basically get away from this transistor paradigm and take an actual mechanical switch that doesn't have any of these disadvantages, miniaturize it, and basically integrate it on a chip, then you would actually have a much, much better switch. And that's what MEMS try to do in the example of switches. Now, because we're talking about RF, it is really important that we remember a few things about how do we characterize a switch, since we started with switches, in the RF domain. So just as a reminder, the only things that truly exist are waves, and in the RF and microwave circuits, we actually measure waves. So this is an example of a two-port device where it's excited from the left port, port one, an instant wave is coming in. Some of this wave will be reflected, some of this will be transmitted. So just as a reminder, the S parameters are nothing else but a way to find how much is the reflected power and how much is transmitted. The same thing, of course, can happen when the device is excited from the second port and the S parameters S22 and S12 are defined. So all the results that you will see in this presentation are actually based on S parameters, which is, again, nothing else but a comparison between reflected transmitted power. So talking about switches, in the off state, the switch ideally should leak nothing, which basically means that the transmission coefficient S21 should be really, really small. In fact, for RF systems, the requirements for switches should be that the leakage should be less than 20 to 60 dB, depending on the system, which basically means that you're looking for leakages of 1 over 100 to 1 over a million of your instant power. That's a really hard requirement to have, particularly if you're doing things with transistors. On the other hand, when the switch is in the on state, you're talking about having as little loss as possible. Again, imagine that if you had a switch that is losing approximately, let's say, 1 dB, which is about 20%, as long as your signal will go through 10 of these switches, you have a tremendous amount of loss. So having a switch with the minimum possible amount of loss is absolutely critical, again, given the fact that in an actual system, the signal will go through a series of them. So we usually talk about switches with an insertion loss of less than 0.2 dB, and usually a reflection coefficient of less than 20 dB, which just means that the switch can pass everything really well with only about 1% reflection. So these are kind of our goals for what a really good switch should look like. And how do you make such a switch? Well, pretty much the same way we make switches in the big world, except that dimensions get a lot smaller. So this is an example of a commercially available switch. It's made by a company called TeraVicta, and it's commercially available right now. It was commercialized about a year ago. And the switch's principle is actually tremendously simple. That's another beauty of MEMS. Conceptually, things are very simple. They get a little harder when you try to fabricate them. But the switch is nothing else but a cantilever beam, which is actually anchored at one electrode, which could be the input line, and it's suspended over another electrode that could be the output line. That cantilever beam is actually fairly flexible, and underneath that beam, there is an actuation electrode. So if a DC voltage is applied between that cantilever beam and the actuation electrode, then there is going to be a coulombic attraction between this beam, we assume here it's metallic, and that electrode. And if that coulombic attraction is strong enough, that beam will actually be pulled downwards and eventually will make contact. So this is a case of a device that is basically operated in two states, pretty much as a transistor is. In the off state, the cantilever is up. In the on state, the cantilever is down. And as you can see, It can very well be approximated with the simple equivalent circuits I presented in the previous slides. Basically, there is a small capacitance when the switch is in the up state and a small contact resistance in the down state. So this is pretty much the basic concept for making such a simple switch. Now, this is a second example of a switch that is also commercially available by Radiant MEMS. Radiant MEMS is basically a startup company. It has been around actually for several years now. And it commercialized the switch that was originally developed by Analog Devices and Northeastern University. Again, the same concept here. There is a cantilever beam. In that case, it's fairly thick. It's approximately 10 microns thick. It's approximately 100 micrometers long. And it's a few micrometers wide. Again, this cantilever beam has two contact pads. So when a voltage is applied, the contact pads actually come down and they make a metal-to-metal contact. I should say that this is the most successful switch that exists right now. It has survived basically more than a trillion cycles of testing. It's, by the way, it's amazing, but if you look at mechanical components that are really big, a trillion cycles is an unimaginable number of cycles. Even for these devices that are fairly small and they respond with fast speeds, 2 to 3 microseconds, a trillion cycles can take over a year and a half to measure. So, and this device shows no fatigue. So we've come a long way through to make devices that are fairly reliable. Now, those devices were basically examples of MEMS using electrostatics to move. There are other mechanisms that can actually help you move a small device. And this table summarizes four of the most popular actuation mechanisms. So electrostatic, which is actually the dominant actuation mechanism, requires fairly high voltage, and this is one of the disadvantages, but requires no current, which basically means that, or rather nearly no current. There is a little bit of current when the switch moves, but once the switch moves, then there is no current anymore. That's why the power consumption of these devices is really, really low. On the other hand, there are several other ways to actuate. Thermal actuation, for example, involves a bimorph beam. So if you can imagine a bimorph cantilever beam made of two different materials, if one material expands more than the other, then if you raise the temperature, the beam will actually deflect. So it's the old concept of a thermostat, just, again, much smaller. Again, you can be using magnetic forces, Lorentz forces, or piezoelectric. So those three, the last three mechanisms have been applied, and they can be useful depending on the application, but electrostatics is by far the dominant way right now, again, because of its power requirements and because of the simplicity involved in making those circuits. So this is a table, actually, that I have taken from a popular RF MEMS book that basically tries to compare, in some terms at least, the different technologies in making switches. And again, switch is really the holy grail, not only the digital domain, but the analog domain as well, as long as you're talking about tunable or reconfigurable systems. So there are several areas where MEMS have really significant advantages over the solid-state technology. The power consumption, as I have mentioned before, is a big one. All of the equivalent RF performance components, so series resistance, series capacitance, isolation, insertion losses, by far those devices perform much, much better, particularly as frequencies get above 10 gigahertz. And finally, the last point is that they're much, much more linear. I mean, the linearity is so high that actually it's very difficult to be measured. And you can actually appreciate that because those devices are purely mechanical, meaning there is no semiconducting junctions there. Now, of course, there are disadvantages as well. As I mentioned before, if a device is electrostatically actuated, it does require fairly high voltage. Now, you can actually generate those voltages starting from 2 or 3 volts using charge pumps, but that requires a little bit of power. By the way, this power is included in that power consumption that they have there for MEMS. For some applications, that's not acceptable. For some others, it is. Many military applications, generating a high voltage is not a problem at all. Switching time. Here you're talking about moving a mass and not an electron. Obviously, it's a lot easier and a lot faster to move an electron, and that's why the switching time of MEMS is nowadays in the order of approximately a microsecond. Now, as the dimensions of these devices actually get smaller and smaller, we can actually start talking about nanosecond speeds. And there have been very recently devices that do operate with switching speeds in the order of 200 nanoseconds. And as the technology progresses, I'm pretty sure that in a few years you will see devices approaching actually single nanoseconds. Finally, the power handling of MEMS switches particularly, it's not where it should be. Nowadays, actually, this table is a couple of years old. Nowadays, 1 or 2 watts is not a problem, but we're still not able to get 50 or 60 watts out of a single device. It's basically work in progress. Also, this chart, again, gives you a comparison of the S parameters of the different switch technologies in the on and in the off state. So on the lower side, you can actually see the leaking rate of a switch in the off state. And as you can see, basically, MEMS devices have superior leakage compared to solid state. And the same thing is true for the upper half of that chart, where we're talking about the insertion loss. I gave you before a couple of examples, and those were simple cantilever beams, beams supported on only one end. There are many designs available in the literature where they basically use different approaches for having a mechanical structure suspended over a circuit. So there is the clamped clap flexure, there is folded flexure, crab legs, and so on. It really depends on the particular circuit you're trying to support, on the available voltage, on how flexible the device needs to be, and so on. For example, the crab leg flexure is much more flexible than the clamped beam, and so on. Now, we're talking about devices that are suspended, and usually those devices are thin films. So they're made of, for example, a thin film metal, or less frequently of thin film dielectric. Unfortunately, the fabrication techniques that we use today, they result in residual stress in those materials. These residual stresses are there even in a classic circuit, except that the classic circuit doesn't move, so you can't actually see them. But here, for example, if you have a device that is fabricated with a film that has a residual tensile stress, it will actually try to compensate for that. And the same thing can happen if you have a residual compressive stress. So as an example, if you had a device that is, let's say, a fixed beam under compressive stress, if that stress is high enough, that device will actually buckle. And that is fairly frequently seen. So one of the lesson learned here is that one of the really fundamental things that you have to pay attention to when you fabricate those devices is controlling stresses a lot more accurately than needed for a conventional circuit. And those stresses, by the way, don't necessarily have to be only tensile or compressive. Depending on the method that we use to deposit those materials, it is possible that the stress varies as a function of the thickness of the beam. It could, for example, happen that on the lower side of the beam, there is compressive stress, and on the upper side, there is tensile, or vice versa. And if that happens, the devices will actually curl, or they will actually warp the minute they are released. So pictures on the right, I actually have an example of a fairly complicated device. It is actually a switch, where the upper picture gives you the device on how it should be when stresses are under control, versus if you cannot control the stresses well enough, which is the bottom picture. And the bottom picture is basically an unusable device. This is approximately a 700 micron long device that is curled about 70 microns. So how did this work exactly? I mean, we understand now that when you have a MEMS beam and you apply a voltage, it might deflect, but how exactly that happened? So again, the nice thing about MEMS is that it's fairly easy to understand, and simple one-dimensional, one-degree of freedom, rather, models can give you a back-on-the-envelope calculation that will give you approximate results. So this is a very common model that people have been using, where basically an electrostatic force is applied on a beam, and that beam is suspended by springs. And those springs could be either cantilevers, could be crab legs, as we saw before, or could be whatever. But whatever beam you have, there's going to be an associated spring constant with it, which will actually try to hold the device in its neutral state. So there are two competing forces. There is the electrostatic force that you can actually calculate just from statics, and it will turn out that that electrostatic force varies as 1 over gap square. On the other hand, the restoring force is proportional to the gap, just Hooke's law. So what happens if you try to put those forces together is actually seen on this graph. And this graph gives you the gap as a function of the voltage. And by the way, the gaps are usually small. We're talking about gaps usually in the order of 2 to 5 microns. So the solid line on this graph gives you how much deflection you're going to get as a function of the voltage. And initially, that deflection is pretty small for a fairly wide voltage range. Up to about, for example, 20 volts, the device has not moved more than 0.2 or 0.3 microns. But there is an instability point, which is reached approximately at 2/3 of the height. Once you cross that point, the device will actually collapse. So there is, if you will, an analog height control for the first 1/2 of the gap, and then the device basically collapses. And that is, again, because the electrostatic force varies as 1 over gap square, and the restoring is proportional to the gap. So it's a pretty common operation of electrostatic devices. Devices that are actuated, of course, electrothermally or with magnetic forces do not show this instability. So electromechanical model is we just saw. Let's see how we can actually have an electromagnetic model developed just by looking at a device. And this example is basically one of the best switches out there that was done by Rockwell Scientific. It's a device that has basically the RF input line, the output line, two actuation pads that actually those pads are made out of silicon dioxide coated with a metal. And basically they have two beams who are suspended, which are suspended on top of the RF and the RF input and output line. So when the device is in the up state, the line is disconnected. When the device is actuated, the input and output lines are connected through those two beams. And of course, the signal has to travel through that distance to go from the left line to the right. And this is actually a pretty accurate equivalent circuit for that switch. And as you can see, very intuitively, all that you're dealing with is basically gaps between metals. And these gaps can very well approximate it with capacitors. On the other hand, on the down state, the gaps are not there anymore. So you have a metal-to-metal contact, which is equivalent of having a small on-state resistance. To give you how accurate those models is, the next two slides will actually present the measurements of this device. So this is a measurement of the isolation, S21, as a function of frequency in the up state. So as you can see, at very low frequencies, the isolation approaches about 60 dB, which is really an excellent result. And even all the way to 50 gigahertz, the isolation does not become worse than 25 dB. And you can actually see very well that the fitted model agrees very well with the measurement and has an equivalent capacitance of only 1.75 femtofarads. So pretty much almost nothing. On the other hand, this graph presents you what happens in the on state, how much loss the switch has. And this graph has two lines, one that is called corrected line and the uncorrected. The uncorrected is basically a measurement that includes not only the loss of the switch itself, but the transmission line underneath the switch. The corrected line has the transmission line de-embedded. So as you can see, the switch itself, all the way to 50 gigahertz, it has a loss of less than 0.2 dBs, which is an unbelievable result. A couple of more examples of different architectures that people have tried, and I'm showing you here one of the most successful ones that actually has been implemented by Linco Labs. This is a switch that is basically made of, again, of a cantilever beam, but this cantilever beam actually has three different materials, silicon oxide, aluminum, and silicon oxide. And as you can see, because of the residual stresses in these materials, the beam naturally curls upwards in its off state. And that actually gives a very, very good isolation between the input and output line. When actuated electrostatically, again, a metal-to-metal contact is made. This is an example of a Raytheon switch. And here the paradigm is slightly different. We have a fixed beam. You can see the two anchor points. The beam itself is made out of aluminum. And when it is actuated, it does not actually make a metal-to-metal contact. when it is actuated, it actually touches a thin layer of dielectric. So it creates basically a very large capacitance, which in the RF world, a very large capacitance is equivalent to a short circuit. So a short circuit here is achieved capacitively, not with a direct metal-to-metal contact. This device, by the way, was one of the most successful devices in the early stages of the RF MEMS. So how do we make those? As I mentioned earlier, you don't need a lot of complexity to make these devices. And this is one example of how you could fabricate a Raytheon type of a switch. The process starts usually by a silicon wafer, and it can very well be glass or silicon carbide, or for that matter, any substrate that is optically smooth, any substrate you can do lithography on. Then there is a metal deposited, which is usually for the lines. There is a thin dielectric layer, usually deposited by a PECVD process, and the metal posts that will be used to support the membrane. Then a sacrificial layer is deposited, and which is shown in number B. And that sacrificial layer can be either a photoresist, a polyamide, a silicon dioxide, depending on exactly the process we're using. This sacrificial layer needs to be planarized in order to have a fairly flat bridge. And after that planarization, the aluminum membrane is deposited. Again, aluminum is in the case of Raytheon. It could be gold. People have tried nickel. A different number of materials can be used. Finally, the sacrificial layer needs to be etched. And that etching happens depending on the process, either by wet techniques or dry etching. The only thing one has to be careful here is in drying these devices. Unfortunately, if you have a wet etch and you try to remove the liquid underneath that bridge, the surface tension of the liquid will actually force the bridge to stick down. So there is a special drying technique using supercritical liquids that have almost no surface tension. And let's go to reliability. One of the most common questions that people ask when they see this technology first is, so how reliable it is? Don't things break? Don't you get a degradation? Well, in order to respond to that question, we first of all need to categorize our MEMS devices. And there are many different categories. In class one, we have devices that basically have absolutely no moving parts. For example, accelerometers that are now embedded in airbags, or pressure sensors. These devices actually have been utilized for over 30 years now, and they had no problem in becoming commercially available. And the reason is because the failure modes are fairly limited. You do need to control particle contamination, which you can do with a pretty good packaging scheme, and you do need to control the shock induced friction, but that's about it. On the other hand, class two includes devices that do have moving parts, but they do not have impacting surfaces. Something does move, for example, in a gyroscope or a resonator or a filter, but doesn't touch anything. Those devices took a little longer to become commercially available, but they eventually did. And for example, the F-bar filters that we'll be talking in a little bit from Agilent are good success stories from this category. The switches that we have been discussing is a class 4 device, meaning a device that has moving parts but also includes impacting and rubbing surfaces. These devices actually have the most difficult failure modes to fight, and that's why they have been late in becoming commercial. As I mentioned, there are two devices right now that are commercially available under this class, but there has been a lot of effort, and there is a lot more effort right now to make even more devices survive and even more complicated. So how do they fail? The first thing that one needs to control is the environment around the switch itself. We're talking about devices that operate and respond to forces in the order of micronewtons. So any little particle, any little piece of dust that gets underneath that cantilever beam over there will make sure that this cantilever beam does not deflect anymore. So the first thing is that they actually need to operate in a very clean environment, and for that reason, we use hermetic packaging. So plastic packages that are okay for digital circuits are not okay here. This particular hermetic package has been developed by Radant MEMS, and it's basically based on a wafer bonding technique via class free bonding, and has been proven to be very, very reliable. Now, once you go past the environment issues, how else this device will fail. There are actually several different modes, and we don't have the time to go through all of them, but one of the dominant failure modes for devices that do rely on metal-to-metal contact is actually the contact itself. Usually, we have films that have some particular roughness, which basically forces the current to go through only a very limited number of asperities that make the actual contact. So there is a constriction effect, and at the same time, there are thin films that might be developed around the contact. This is an example of a contact that was actually melted by passing too much current through it. And as I mentioned before, usually there is only a limited number of asperities that make contact, which basically means that those asperities will get heated and will reach temperatures a lot higher than everything around them. So one needs to be careful on how much current you can actually pass, and this is, by the way, the reason that we don't have devices that can handle 50 watts today, is because of that. Now, besides the constriction effect, there are issues with the films that might be developed on the contacts. Whenever you have a metal and it's exposed to air, it will oxidize, unless it's a noble metal, but even then you have some type of contamination, even if it's simple carbon. Now, those thin films that usually are not a problem in a virgin asperity, when the asperities start contacting each other with sufficiently high forces, these films will actually be developed. And this is known as an effect where you basically have a chemistry happening because of mechanical motion, because of forces. And those films can be breaking down, but they require a lot of high force, which usually is not available in those devices. So there has been a number of metals that have been tried. By far, the most common metal is gold because it doesn't oxidize. But gold is a fairly soft metal, so after enough actuations, you will actually have mechanical damage. Silver and nickel are also metals that have been tried before. And at the same time, people have tried refractory metals. People have tried hardened gold. There are a lot of different configurations and possibilities for contacting metallic films. There hasn't been a film that has shown the best performance today, and also a lot of this data is proprietary by companies. This is probably one of the most important research topics today in that area, is to find out exactly what happens at the contact. It's one of the most difficult things to find out, and also one of the most rewarding research topics. Okay, what else can you do beyond switches? Switches is definitely not the end of the story. And although switches are very useful, there are a number of other devices that can be very useful as well. Variable capacitors, or varactors, is one of them. And here you can see a picture of a digital varactor. How do you make a digital varactor? Pretty simple. Pick several fixed capacitors, and using switches, maybe pick one of them, or two, or three, or so on. So this is an example that was actually done by Raytheon. And as you can see on the left picture, you can have a nice capacitance over a fairly wide frequency range. And you can select how much capacitance you need for your particular circuit. Of course, having a digital varactor is not the only way you can do it. Rockwell has developed a very nice analog varactor, and of course a lot of others, but this is just an example, where you actually utilize motion between metallic fingers to actually achieve a variable gap in a capacitor. Inductors. Besides switches and varactors, one of the most difficult things that exists today is making a good inductor. Inductors are inherently a three-dimensional device, but in the old days, when we only could have planar integrated circuits, we had to make inductors being planar. By trying to make a 3D structure to a planar implementation, what truly happens is that you create a lot of parasitics. Instead of, for example, creating an inductor, you actually create a circuit on the left, which is an inductor with a lot of capacitance and loss around it. So the MEMS technology has actually been able to make inductor fabrication a lot easier, and we have been able to make a lot better inductors. How do you do that? making thicker metals for lower loss, making truly 3D solenoidal inductors, or even removing the substrate to reduce the loss. And this is one of the examples by MEMSCAP, where they were able to integrate, electroplate 10 microns of copper to create basically a really high quality factor of about 40 at 5 gigahertz. Another example is, again, removing the inductor from the substrate. And this is an example by KAIST in Korea, where they have basically suspended inductors approximately 50 microns away from a lossy substrate and has tremendously increased the quality of those inductors. Inductors are usually fairly big, so underneath that inductor, you can actually put the circuit and save space. So once you have those fundamental components, a switch, a varactor, and a capacitor, you can actually start making tunable circuits. And we don't have the time to see a lot of them, but I'm going to present a couple of examples, like the one on this slide. This is a tunable filter by Raytheon, approximately around 1 gigahertz, and has been implemented by the variable capacitors that you saw before. So depending on how many capacitors you actually activate, you can control the frequency between 885 megahertz to 986 megahertz. Another example of a tunable filter at a lower frequency this time is by Rockwell. Well, again, they have used the variable capacitor that you saw before, along with off-chip inductors to make a tunable filter approximately from 240 to about 400 megahertz. Now, let me shift gears a little bit here and give you some different examples of MEMS. Because MEMS, particularly RF MEMS, is not only limited to the devices we've seen before. There are a lot of examples in our world, the big world, where can be actually implemented in the small world. For example, the beams we have resonating that we make musical instruments with are nothing else but beams under tension where we hit them and they resonate and we hear some sound. The nice thing about those beams is that they actually output only one sound and they're extremely selective for that. And that's why the music is so nice. Well, you can do the same thing if you start shrinking those the dimensions. If you take, for example, a string of a guitar and you shrink it enough, then you will have a micro-mechanical resonator. In other words, you will have a resonator that if you are able to excite, this time you won't hit it by hand, but you excite it with a voltage, it will actually start resonating. But it will resonate only if you excite it with a voltage that is at the same frequency as the natural frequency of this resonator. In other words, you have just made a filter. A resonator that responds only to one voltage. And those resonators, as you will see in a second, are so useful because they're so, so selective. They're actually among the best filters in this world today. This is one example fabricated by Professor Clark Nguyen's group, where we basically have a fixed beam. It's approximately 40 microns long, 8 microns wide, and resonates at about 8.5 megahertz. The graph actually on the left gives you the transmission loss through this resonator, and it's interesting to see the scale on the bottom, where the difference is only 0.01 megahertz. So this is an extremely selective device, and it has a quality factor of 8,000. And when you start having quality factors that are that high, you can actually start thinking of doing channel selection not on the IF, but rather on the RF. Now, those quality factors are difficult but can be maintained for higher frequencies, and you will see an example in a little bit. What is a little bit harder to happen is it's harder to keep the reference impedance of this resonator to 50 ohms as the frequency gets higher. This is another research topic right now. It's fairly easy to do at 8 megahertz. It's okay to do it at 100 megahertz, but when we start crossing the gigahertz range, the impedance of these resonators actually becomes quite high. Now, before, in the previous slide, I showed you a filter made with one resonator. This is an example of two resonators. They are basically coupled with a thin beam, and they resonate very well at 7.8 megahertz with a bandwidth of only 15 kilohertz. Again, extremely selective devices. What happens at higher frequencies? People have spent a lot of time trying to optimize a design at higher frequencies, and it has only been very recently that acceptable resonators have been implemented. And this is a resonator that is implemented based on a stem. So you basically have a disk that basically becomes smaller and bigger around an anchor point. This particular one is operated in the second radial mode, and it has achieved actually a quality factor of more than 10,000 even in air. The ones I showed you before, they had achieved those quality factors in vacuum. This one is even in air. The only disadvantage of such a resonator is the fact that it's fairly mismatched to a 50-ohm system. So research is actually underway right now to try to bring those impedances closer to 50-ohm. However, these resonators, as you can see, works at 1.5 gigahertz. So the frequencies are getting higher and higher. Finally, let me present just a couple of slides on another MEMS technology that has a name of FBAR. This is the technology, actually, that has been commercialized by Agilent. And Agilent right now has the best FBAR filters, at least commercially available. And FBAR stands for Film Bulk Acoustic Resonator. So in order to understand how those filters operate, we have to see what are they made of. And in the particular case of Agilent, they're made of a piezoelectric material, which is the aluminum nitride. And on the picture on the left-hand side, you can actually see the aluminum nitride, and you can see the aluminum atoms and the nitrogen atoms. What happens in that when the aluminum nitride gets disorientation is that it actually elongates if you apply a field upwards, and it actually gets compressed if the film is in the opposite direction. So in other words, you have a piezoelectric material. But if you fix the ends of such a beam or a plate, then that will happen only if you apply the right frequency. If you flip the frequency, then that resonance will happen, but only if the frequency is the one is the same as the cell, as the natural frequency of that device. So you can make a filter as shown on the right-hand side, where basically we have coupled plates, and you have basically an FBAR filter. Now, the FBAR filters are really the best filters right there, at least in the low gigahertz regime. The FBAR filters are available right now in most of our cell phones, and Agilent is selling several millions of them. And they have been able to demonstrate an unbelievable performance. What you can see actually on the left side is the brick wall type of attenuation that such a filter has outside of its passband, and with a loss of only 3.5 dB. And this data, by the way, is back in 2003. And in addition to that, the size of those filters is incredibly small. This particular example is less than 2 mm³. So to put it simply, the FBAR filters are better in everything as compared to what existed before them, which is the dielectric or the soft filters. So what should be the take-home lessons? There are actually a lot of different things that you can say about MEMS, but I think that the following points will capture at least most of them. So the first thing is that the RF MEMS technology was really the first technology that allowed us to generate ideal devices. We couldn't really have good inductors, good switches before that. So it is really a leap in terms of in the RF technology. The second thing is that really for about 15 years now, people have been doing a lot of work on implementing a number of different tunable devices using the components available today. Tunable antennas, impedance tuners, phase shifters, tunable filters, and so on. There are tens of them published right now in the literature with really, really, really unbelievable results. Failure modes do exist. We haven't solved all of them. There has been a lot of research, particularly recently, on identifying what the failure mechanisms are and how to resolve it. There is certainly a lot more to be done there, but the good thing is that the solutions are being found, and given that this technology is relatively new, once it matures, it's fairly certain that it will find its way out there. Also, if you look at the funding profile of that research, most of it has really been coming from DARPA and DOD, particularly in the United States. And most of it so far has been performed from small companies and universities. Now, the encouraging thing is that new and big players are coming into the picture, including IBM and JAS, that now they actually have processes, MEMS processes, that are compatible with CMOS. So in the same wafer, they can actually have a MEMS component and regular CMOS. So that is a very, very encouraging point on how that will actually go. And we believe that large companies and more of them will get involved. Now, whether you are going to see cell phones with MEMS, that we're not sure yet. What really will decide that is really the cost. And areas where are willing to pay to get the high performance, for example, in military applications, will get MEMS much, much sooner. But in areas where the cost dominates, may or may not happen. For example, the TeraVecta switch I mentioned is sold today at $35 per switch. It's for sure it will come down, but it really has to hit the target of $0.3 to $0.5 to actually make it in a wireless component. So that remains to be seen. There are both optimists and pessimists over there. Finally, don't underestimate mechanical circuits. They can be a lot better than electrical, and I'm an electrical engineer. So thank you very much, and I'll be interested to hear any questions. Please.
We have understood the basic principle of operation of MEMS circuit in slide number 10. But my question is that when we are applying an AC signal to the gate of the transistor, maybe it's of high frequency, then due to this to and fro movement of the electrode, shouldn't the moment of inertia of that cantilever matter? It should restrain the frequency?
Yes, it does. Now, it depends on the frequency of the applied AC signal. The natural frequency of those cantilevers are in the order of kilohertz. So if the AC signal is below kilohertz, then the cantilever will actually follow it. However, if it is above that, then it will not. And usually, in those cases, the AC signal is in the gigahertz range, so the cantilever will actually not follow it. It's not fast enough to respond to that. Now, that is becoming important if you start having two tones. If you start having two tones into the system, then the mixing will actually, if the two tones are close enough, the mixing will actually be in the kilohertz range, which actually will create intermodulation distortion in the cantilever. That intermodulation distortion is there, but it's still orders of magnitude smaller than what it would have been if you were using a transistor.
Is that system scalable enough so that we can accommodate a larger frequency instead of? Because as we reduce the dimension of the cantilever, mm-hmm. we're going to have a lower moment of inertia that can follow the
high. That's right. And that's exactly what happens in the micromechanical filters that I described. The focus there is on making things smaller so they can respond to higher frequencies. Because over there, you are actually utilizing mechanical resonance to create an RF system. So the disk, for example, that I presented is in the order of a few microns, really. In order to have that response at 1.5 gigahertz. So scaling it and pushing the frequency higher, the micromechanical resonators is not the easiest thing in the world because as the frequency gets higher, then the losses, for example, from the anchor points become more and more significant, so it's higher to keep the high Q. This is actually the reason why you see a mismatch of the impedance because the only way to maintain that Q is to constrain the movement of that resonator, which actually suits its impedance high. So it's not an easy problem, and it's not clear if going beyond, let's say, 1 or 2 gigahertz will happen with those resonators or will happen with other technologies. For example, the FBAR technology has already reached 10 gigahertz. So it's a very nice and competing technology with that.
I have a question. How sensitive is the cantilevers to external things other than the voltage that you apply or thermal?
Right. So it depends a lot on their size and materials. For example, if we are talking about how sensitive they are to vibration, because of their incredibly small mass, usually in the order of 10 to the negative 13 kilograms, they are not sensitive at all. The noise generated by vibration is really insignificant compared to other noise sources. Now, if we are talking about sensitivity to huge types of acceleration, for example, the ones that could be experienced by a launch of a rocket, then there has to be some some type of careful design there to make sure the cantilever is supported to not respond to that. In terms of being sensitive to thermal stimulus, again, it depends on the material. If it's made of a single material that actually expands or contracts uniformly, then usually the performance is acceptable. Plus, you can always have a feedback mechanism to tune it back. If it's made from different materials, then that might be a problem. Actually, there are teams that are working on biomorph cantilevers to respond to temperature as a sensor. I haven't covered sensor technology at all, but primarily it's the same process. So, short answer, that hasn't been the major concern right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned that the switching time for these micromechanical sensors are in the order of microseconds.
Yes.
So how do they operate in the gigahertz range?
Okay, so there are two frequencies we're talking about. One is the frequency of the signal that propagates through that device. That's the gigahertz frequency. The other is the frequency at which the mechanical device itself responds. So when I said microseconds, I meant from the time you push the button to, let's say, close the switch, until it closes, that takes 1 microsecond. But once it is closed, the bandwidth of the signals that can go through that switch is actually tens of gigahertz. So there are these are the two different frequencies mixed there. Something else?
Yes. So the cantilever
suffered
from fatigue after they
went
so many cycles?
Mm-hmm. So, surprisingly, no. And the reason for that is that, at least for conventional MEM switches, the distance that these devices move is really small compared to their size. For example, for the Radiant case, it moves, let's say, by 2 microns, and it's about 100 microns long. So the aspect ratio is actually high. So it moves, but it moves a little bit. So fatigue is really not an issue. Now, if we're talking about a device that does move significantly, and there are sensors that actually will move tens of microns, then fatigue becomes an issue. And so far, research has been concentrated a lot on devices with small deflections. But now it's time to look at devices for large with large deflections. And then fatigue will become an issue. Material nonlinearities will become an issue, and potentially fracture, crack propagation, you know, Pandora's box.
Okay, so if there are not any more questions, let's thank our speaker.
Okay, thanks a lot.